I am Zach.
And I'm Ben.
And welcome to the Movie Vault. Today we are going to review The Goonies. And wow, this is a touchy movie for many people as it is dear to many hearts in this patriotic country.
It is a cult classic. Mm-hmm. Yes. Which means that a lot of people love it even though they weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
Isn't that how that works? It's like the studios make it and they're like, okay, this is going to be like a small movie. And then everyone decides that they like it. Or at least there's a big section of moviegoers who are like, I really like this movie. And then they're like, okay, it's a cult classic now.
When I was young, my grandfather told me two things. He said, Zach, you marry rich the first time. And then the second thing he told me was that everyone, including girls, want what they can't have. And that's why people love this movie, because they weren't supposed to love it. And they just wanted to show that they could.
That's wow. And we can just end it now. We can end the podcast.
As that may be the truest and worst advice I have received in my life, I will continue on in gratitude for it.
Yeah.
This is a 1985 comedy film, adventure film, Spielbergian, Donnerian film. And it is directed by Richard Donner and Chris Columbus, not Christopher Columbus, made the screenplay. And Steven Spielberg workshopped the story.
Sort of the trifecta here. Oh, Chris Columbus, sure. Of course, you know, directed Home Alone.
I did not know that.
Yes.
He also sailed the ocean blue in his other life.
And I think he was involved in a lot of writing of these types of movies. He wrote Gremlins.
Okay.
He wrote Little Nemo, Adventures in Slumberland. That was well before
Finding
Nemo.
Before the Finding.
He directed Mrs. Doubtfire. He directed Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So, you know, he's a commodity.
That's a weird filmography.
Yeah, I think he's more of a, he's not really an auteur. He's like a, you hire him to direct movies.
Type of
person. Like, he's trustworthy. In the business. Yeah. You know what else he directed? Pixels.
Oh, Adam Sandler. that is fitting, movie? As our next film is Adam Sandler centric.
Yeah. Man. Wow.
Yeah, so it stars Sean Astin, Josh Brolin, Jeff Cohen, Corey Feldman, Cary Grant, Martha Plimpton, and Kei Hoi Kwan. I did not pronounce that right. And yeah, it's basically about these kids, and they are self-proclaimed Goonies because they live in the Goondocks. They're in Astoria, Oregon. Is that how you say it? Astoria?
I think it's Astoria, yeah.
You're pretty good with geography.
Yeah. Is it a real place? It is a real place.
It is a real place. We'll get into that. We'll also get into, I didn't comment, but we'll get into why that there is a connection to another of Chris's projects. But let's go forward. So there are these kids. They are obviously, they've been friends for a long time on the Goondocks. One of them, the main character, Mikey, who's kind of this reluctant leader / younger brother of the heroic older brother, which is Josh Brolin. And Mikey knows this tale of One-Eyed Willie and this treasure that is somewhere within the Goondocks. And these kids are all pretty excited after they find in their attic a treasure map and a few other trinkets and goodies that can help them find this treasure. So eventually they go on this adventure where they're being chased by this family of criminals, and these criminals are also trying to find the treasure, and they're the Fratelli crime family, and it's the mother, and Francis and Jake are her two sons. And they ended, as they're going along and finding this, we'll skip over it, they ended up for most of the movie they have Chunk, which is one of the main characters who really loves food, and he's a kid, and Chunk goes to try to alert the police, and they end up catching him. And Chunk meets this guy in the basement called Sloth, who is kind of deformed in some ways and seems to be, of lower intelligence. And but he's very lovable and strong, and they become really good friends. And even though Chunk calls the sheriff, they think he's just lying again. Boy cried wolf, or the boy who cried wolf. I haven't kept up with my fairy tales lately. Do they still make fairy tales? I'm just wondering. Or are those
does that have to be like old, and then like once the story is old enough, it becomes a fairy tale?
I wonder if that is true, or I'm wondering.
Like, it has to be a folk tale kind of thing before they decide it's a fairy tale.
I think this is my theory. This is kind of out there. I think there are some truth to fairy tales that at some time existed, and as they've been passed down by oral tradition, they have been changed and mishapped.
Like embellished.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say embellished, but this is how out there I am.
Okay.
I would say many fairy tales are based on true stories, but we know what that means in the movie culture.
Right, right. So,
anyway, so they end up finding surviving against booby traps or booty traps. That's what I said. And they stay ahead of the Fratellis a bunch of times like that in every scene. And they end up finding some clues in these caves, and they go deeper and deeper and deeper into these caverns. They start arguing. These two other girls join them who aren't really Goonies. A few people kiss each other. A few people don't realize that they're kissing each other. And then they get to the place where Willy's pirate ship is, an amazing set piece, which they go within, and that's where the final battle ensues. And it's called the Inferno, and it's anchored and has all the treasure, and they collect all this treasure. But Mikey seems to have this weird connection with Willy, and we'll get into that later, but that exists there. And then the Fratellis take away their stuff and make them walk the plank, but Chunk and Sloth come in the last second to swing in and save, you know, everybody. And they distract the Fratellis, and they, yeah, there are more kisses that happen, actually. And there are booby traps with Data, and they escape, basically, with the help of Chunk and Sloth. And as they go onto the beach, everybody reunites with their families. Everybody's happy, as they're somehow, Chunk's family brought pizza, and as this seems like a bad time to maybe do some housing paperwork, but as they're reuniting with their families, the people who are coming to foreclose on the house come with the paperwork.
And yeah, that's really great timing for those guys.
And they realize something bigger is going on. The housemaid finds some gems that were hidden in a sack, and they have enough money to negate the foreclosure. And yeah, so they tell their adventures, and people don't really believe them. But then the Inferno sails off into the distance, and people are like, what is going on? And that is the closure that we get. And it's pretty good. So I'll say with that. So with that, the first things first, Ben, is this your first time watching it?
So I saw part of the Goonies like on cable at my grandma's house. It was like towards the end, so I didn't really understand what was happening. But I remember the scene like where they got to the ship and then like the ship sailing off. But you know, it's one of those things where it's like it's on in the background, so you kind of like catch pieces of it. It wasn't like a sit down and view it. So this time was the first time I actually like understood the story and watched the movie.
Okay, so the entire story was new to you?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Did you know when you watched it the first time any of these actors that you did you recognize anyone, or did you recognize them only now?
Oh, only now. I mean, back when I saw, I wouldn't have recognized anybody.
Oh, like, how old were you again?
I don't even remember, but I think I was like middle school or younger. I wouldn't have been familiar with like Sean Astin, or maybe I would have been familiar with Sean Astin, but not like Josh Brolin or any of those guys.
Do you think it's hard to remember how old you are in old memories?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay.
Sometimes there's something specific you can link it to. Like, I know this was going on. But then other times it's like, this is a memory I have, but I can't, it's vaguely, there's like a range of ages where you're like, I could believe I was that old when I saw that, but I'm not as sure.
My fifth birthday party was a Dora the Explorer birthday party. It might've been my fourth, but in my head, I pictured the balloons saying like 8 or 9, right? But in my memory, I know that's not possible, as I pretty much changed into a more masculine figure as I moved to Ohio. So I doubt that was the case.
Interesting. Dora the Explorer at age 4.
Mm-hmm. I know.
That was back when you were in Detroit.
And Diego was around by then.
When you had serial killers living next to you.
I did. Yeah, we had a serial killer. It's a great thing to talk about with Goonies. But as these Fratellis are kind of coming off to kill these kids, I noticed the mother. First of all, I will not lie to you. I for the first 10 scenes, I thought that was a male. And that's all I'll say about that, okay? And I'm not saying that she is not feminine. I'm saying that was my first impression. It was the beret. That's what I'll say. The sons don't really get too much characterization as the movie goes on. Nobody really gets too much characterization. But I was thinking about the overall plots. I was thinking about the overall overarching story. This really doesn't have anything like that. It's more of just an adventure. And I'm okay with that. And it really is kind of hollow. And it seems like it might be just an amalgamation of scenes that almost represent the caves that they're within. Just, you know, what's within is fun. It's not necessarily substantive, just like the characters that are within those caves. So maybe it's just a metaphor, or maybe not.
You know, I was thinking about this, and I think this movie might be a little bit, might have more to it than meets the eye a little bit.
Are you going to go into that theory that I told you about?
No, I'm not. Okay, it's not that much more than meets the eye. Okay. But I was just thinking about it. This has so many, it's just, such a fun movie to watch. Because
is that more than meets the eye?
I mean,
did my eye not meet
let
the
me,
fun?
Let my thoughts continue, sorry, okay, Zach?
Ahead. Sorry.
Maybe it's not more than meets the eye, but maybe it is. Think about all of the things it starts. The lovable loser, the chunk, and his friend, the huge giant.
Sloth.
Is that what his name is? His name's Sloth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lotany for Telly, or Sloth. Oh. Yeah. Sloth and Chunk, their friendship, and, being that, finding that camaraderie. You feel compassion for Sloth as he's, kind of being, abused by his family members for his, brute strength. Was this guy also in The Princess Bride?
I don't know. I've seen that movie once because...
Wait, are you kidding me?
What?
I thought this guy was, that's what he actually looked like. But
Sloth?
Yeah, in real life.
No, he's a football player. I thought you were talking about Chunk.
Yeah, no. Now I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I'm getting him mixed up with somebody else. Okay,
so there's more than meets your eye.
Yeah. Apparently. Okay. Apparently, I couldn't understand what makeup was.
Well, my Oho is well acquainted with what is going on. I think...
You get all of the, teen angst, or some teen angst, and then you get the, coming of age.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, it's a little stereotypical. You got these big, oh, our houses are getting foreclosed and we have to move.
Sure.
Plot that doesn't exactly make a lot of sense. I guess they're redeveloping this area that's supposed to be bad, but it doesn't even look that bad of an area. It's supposed to be the terrible part of town, but you're you look at the houses and it's not really that bad.
It's those Disney Channel original TV series that say oh yeah, we can't afford that. And they live in these very extremely nice suburban neighborhoods. You're
I wonder where everyone else lives. If this is the terrible part of
the standards are set.
It's like saying the house I grew up in is a really bad place to live.
Yeah.
Because I'm just comparing it to all the other houses around.
Yeah. And you're rich.
Yeah. And I'm rich.
Yep.
So well, I mean, I'm not rich, but my parents are.
Yeah. Well, now that we've crossed the bridge.
Rich by the standards of if you compared to the whole entire world, then yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much everybody I know would be very rich.
Do we include infants in that count? Because then
you're right.
I'm
you're right. You kind of have to take out kids a little bit.
Okay.
Except for the YouTuber ones.
Okay. You're right. Kids without incomes.
Yeah. But although technically that gets confusing because the kids' incomes isn't really theirs. I think their parents have access to it to a certain age.
Does that depend on the state?
Maybe it could depend on certain legislation, yeah.
I'm wondering if that's why all the YouTubers are in, California.
Maybe.
Where you can basically claim your own independency at age 2.
Wow.
No, I'm just joking.
Okay. But so maybe I haven't really proved that this movie has more to meet than meets the eye, but I'm just saying it's a lovely movie.
No. There may be more than meets both of our collective eyes, four. I think maybe... The best part of this film, and we'll get into my least favorite part, the best part of this film are the interactions between the characters.
Yeah.
They're not, they're already close. The characters don't have to develop some kind of relationship in this film.
No.
It's already established. The brothers love each other. I mean, there's no fighting in between them. There isn't even, there's the speech at the end that Mikey makes, we are Goonies, you know? We never say die. That speech is about as tough as it gets, you know? They're in that cave. There's no surety of death. In fact, when the Fratellis have been holding Chunk hostage, they've only been asking him, like, what's the word, you know, what have you done? And he's just telling him, you know.
He's just telling him, I ate ice cream once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the stakes really aren't that high.
And except for you get to the booby traps, and some of them are actually, like, they could have died. So it's kind of weirdly high stakes. But I guess you're right. They never seriously feel threatened.
For sure. Until the end, when she's about to walk the plank.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a really, really fun adventure. I really enjoyed Josh Brolin's character. He's just such an interesting guy. Like, he's, like, supposed to be this tough guy who normally in the movies would be a jerk to his little brother, right? But he's hugging his little brother. He's being a good, supportive brother.
And he cares so much. Like, he's, like, he takes his responsibility of, like, making sure that they stay in the house, like, so seriously that he, like, rides... He steals a little girl's bike and rides it down and risks, like, embarrassment, which he does get embarrassed then.
Yeah. But then the girls end up joining him, so they think it's kind of hot. Yeah.
Yeah. They think it's, like, cute. Like, he likes his
bike. Oh, he's riding a little girl's bike.
Yeah. Because the bad guys don't always win, okay? Yeah. That's what we learned from this movie.
Yeah, and they're really, to be fair, there isn't really closure for those other jocks that were driving, the one that put the mirror on that girl.
Actually, the girls just seem kind of, like
did this pass the
wayward, because they're like, oh, I want to hang out with this guy, but he's not currently available, so I guess I'll have to hang out with this other guy who's, like, kind of a jerk, but I guess I have to hang out with him. That's what the female character struck me as.
I would even say...
Because wasn't he, like, trying to look up her skirt?
Yeah, with the mirror.
And she was just like, oh, ha, ha,
kind of. No, she was kind of mad a little bit.
She was mad a little bit, but she... You could tell she, like...
Josh Brolin.
She, like, brushed it off somewhat, though.
Sure.
But... She may have felt like in that situation, you may feel like there's nothing you can do in the moment. Yeah. So that's fair.
It did not pass the Bechdel test.
It did not, no.
Everything that they said was about a guy. Whatever, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. The female characters don't make sense.
Sure. Like,
the way they reacted to things probably isn't how girls would have reacted to those
even
things.
The progressive character still ended up kind of with a guy at the end. And that's, you know, that's fine. That's whatever. I'm not the most concerned person in the world with that, okay?
Yeah.
I'll admit that. So you have these kids. You have a group of kids. You have Chunk, who you said is the lovable loser. You have Data, who is kind of the guy who has the gadgets, the booby traps.
He's like the nerd of the group.
And he's also like extremely creative too.
Yep.
You have Mikey, who's the heart of the group. You can tell he's the glue. He's the guy that holds everyone together. Then you have Mouth, who speaks Spanish, apparently. And that's really his skill, but he's also got a big mouth.
He's a little bit more of the jerk of the group, because all the stuff he says to the maid in Spanish, where he's like, I forget exactly what he says. Or he talks about, like, there being cocaine and, like,
he's talking about the drugs, like the marijuana, you put it in the drawer, and then you go downstairs, we're gonna lock you here if you don't follow everything.
Yeah, he's more of he's a mischievous. I mean, they're all kind of mischievous, but he's more of a mischievous in a jerkish way.
Yeah, he's a rugrat. And I think the older brother, Josh Brolin's character, is also great in that. The girls, we already said about them. That's really the group right there. Am I missing
Andy and Steph? Yeah.
Yeah, Andy and Steph. That's correct. I don't think I'm missing anyone, am I?
No,
I'm
pretty sure that was the main
force. So you have these characters who all have their different skills at some time are used. You know, Data setting the traps. He puts the oil shoes on the pipe that they're crossing. You know, you have Chunk, who brings in Sloth because he's so lovable and he loves food so much that he brought a baby Ruth and made friends. That's his skill, is apparently being hungry. And Mikey, who gives that speech at the end to keep motivating them. You have you gotta remind me of Josh Brolin's character. I keep forgetting, but he's the one who kind of keeps everyone safe. And he's like the grunt of the group. And you have all these people with different skill sets and Mouth with the Spanish bilingual skills. So it really does show teamwork. It shows how unity doesn't have to be constantly fought against. I feel like it was a great showing of we can make a movie where there are two characters that are not predictably, where there are more than two characters not predictably going against an ideological difference between them and fighting it out and compromising. You know, that's what many movies are these days and back then as well. It really was a different film. It felt different. Even like there were many scenes where there was no scoring. They felt silent. And I was like, they're just talking. They're in a cave. They're talking. Normally there would be some music, but there wasn't. And it felt to me, awkward. But by the end of the film, I was used to it, and I thought it was much better. It felt for a different feel. What do you think about the feel?
I think there's somewhat of a magical feel, which some people would call Spielbergian, and I guess, you know, his influence in the film is probably noted, but I think it's a little bit different than Spielberg films. It just feels like it has that tone of just being an adventure, and like, it doesn't have a plot that's like, they set up a problem, and then you get your like solution at the end. But in a lot of ways, I felt like the movie is like the cave. It's like you start and then you keep going in the cave and going in the cave until you finally get to the end. It's like much more linear. It's not like, it's like they discover something, and then that results in them having to make a decision, and they discover another thing, and that results in them having to make a decision. Mm-hmm. It's not, they don't get all caught up in like, yeah. And I feel like in some other movies, they'd like find the thing, and then they like go back, and they'd be like, oh, we got to talk about this for a little bit.
Stranger
and then they go back.
Season 4 when they went back to the prison.
Yes.
That's my first thought.
Exactly. Or even Stranger Things is a great example, because there's a lot of like, sort of like putting their foot in the door of whatever it is that they're trying to discover, and then like pulling away and being like, no, we can't do this. Whereas this movie, they like have to make decisions, and they like, it's all happens in one night.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's it. Maybe it's the time constraint.
And Spielberg,
they say tomorrow our house is getting foreclosed, so this is the last day that they have to do this.
Unless there's time travel.
Yeah. Unless there's time travel.
With Spielberg and Donner in Columbus, I feel like they are pretty good at committing to an under 2 hour runtime, specifically with a fun classic adventure film. And with this film, I think your analogy of the cave going deeper and deeper is perfect. And that's what I was kind of alluding to in the beginning. Just that the analogy of the cave to the film itself is so linear, so simple and uncomplex that... Is that a word? Uncomplex?
More or less like not complicated.
Okay. I'm content with that. Yeah. It's not complicated. Or is it uncomplicated a word?
That might be a word.
Okay.
Yeah, I think uncomplicated is a word, yes.
Okay, I'm just tired. So, anyway, the story itself just has it goes from... Yeah, you're right. There's no backtracking in any ideas. There's not even pushback from characters. There's not even, like, a call... There aren't really callbacks either, if you think about it. The callbacks themselves have nothing to do with the ideological structure of the film itself. It has more to do with, like, funny running gags throughout the film, such as gadgets or mouth-to-mouth... Or, you know, Mikey and the girl, what's her face? Irene. Is it Irene? No, that's the mother. I'm thinking of Andrea? Andy, right? Is it Andy?
Yeah, Andy.
Girl? I'm sorry, I'm bad with
hey,
these names.
Andy, you goonie.
Yes, correct. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting. So that's there are a few running gags, but the story itself is pretty simple. And I think that's to its benefit. Now, getting into the lore of the film, the One-Eyed Willy, have you heard the phrase One-Eyed Willy before?
One-Eyed Willy.
Have you heard that?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whether I can like point to where I've heard of it from.
I'm not sure if the lore goes deeper than the film itself, but I've heard that in many cases before even watching this film, and this is my second time watching it. Now, it seems that as if Mikey had some kind of psychic connection with One-Eyed Willy. He said that he was the original Goonie, right?
Interesting.
And I have searched the web to figure out what that is, and the theories go far and wide, right? What do you think?
So I think that when he says he's the original Goonie, maybe he's talking about the fact that One-Eyed Willy, like, had all of the aspects of like the spirit of what the Goonies were trying to be. Like, so in some ways he's like their spiritual forefather. I don't know if that's the right word, but if being a Goonie is their religion, then he is like the first person. He's not God in this scenario. I don't know whether I'm using a very sound analogy here, but he's like an important figure in the establishment of this religion.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
I'm not sure if I thought it was a religion.
I'm trying to, it's not a religion, like, exactly. It's more of like a lifestyle. So maybe like,
I see.
He's like the guru at the beginning of the life stuff. Yeah, he's like the shaman. Okay. Maybe religion's like the wrong word, because they're not ultimately, you know, they could probably be Goonies and still be religious.
Okay, the secular version of religion would be life coach.
Yeah, maybe the life coach.
Okay, yeah,
But I feel like the idea of religion sort of is too confining.
No, I see what you mean. You're using religion as an analogy.
Yeah, it's an analogy.
I think you are exactly right. I think the elements of that are there. I think One Eye Willie is kind of this person who encapsulated the spirit of the Goonies, who kind of laid out this plan that, I mean, if you really think about it, like, what needed to be done to get to this treasure? A bunch of puzzles, right? So you have all these booty traps, that's what I said, trying to get past all those. You have to do this giant skeleton piano thing.
Oh, yeah. And then, like, the things fall off.
Like, what in the world? Yeah. That reminded me of the Game of Thrones throne. I haven't seen that, by the way. But moving on.
You totally have not seen that.
No, I have not. But the Throne of Bones, I mean, that's cool. The Bone Throne. That sounds inappropriate. I mean, there are just these cool puzzles that you kind of have to go through. It seems like a mastermind, almost like a Saw-level puzzle that you have to get through, except less gory and their children here.
You know what it also reminds me of? What? Kind of Indiana Jones. Yeah. There's a lot of Indiana Jones-esque elements
and that makes sense.
This is. It's just like kids.
Yeah, Mr. S did a lot of that in here too. But yeah, I think what you said fits perfectly, just because he almost is the spiritual forefather, and he's the first Goonie because the location is also the Goondocks. He's there.
Right.
He has the ship that has been there long before they had been established there and long before they had formed their group. And it seems as if Willie had thought about this, because he was the one who introduced it. What? You guys don't know about One-Eyed Willie? And he told them the story, right? So it seems like he had been thinking about this lore because his father told him the stories for so long that he pictured him as this all-time adventurer before his time, who is dead now, that they have to carry on his legacy in this former fashion.
Yeah.
And that's why he leaves some treasure for him, too, to pay homage.
And in some strange way, it's almost like Willie is also looking out for them, because without Willie...
Maybe it is religion.
Without Willie, they have no opportunity. It's like Willie laid out the treasure map just for them to discover it so that they could pay back. And it's not for them to become... They could pay back like the debts that their parents had, or buy the houses fully, or whatever. I'm not even sure they're
really preordained.
No, it's not that concrete, but it's this that maybe it would be how as a kid you would view it.
So you're a Willie Molinist.
Yeah, it's not. It's like sort of free will, but sort of predestined in like a strange way. Okay. Yeah, it's like in between.
Okay,
which can't exist exactly, but
and him leaving the treasure for Willie was kind of his sacrificial lamb. I see.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. I see the connections for sure.
Yeah, but it's also interesting. They took just enough to pay back their house. They were trying to take more. They didn't end up being able to.
Yes.
I feel like there's some symbolism there where it's like they didn't become rich off of Willie's spoils.
And that wasn't their goal. Even when they were surrounded with treasure, was to say, hey, we need to pay for this house, and that's it.
Yeah.
They filled their pockets. They could have. There were buckets.
I mean, they didn't know the exact figure of how much they needed, so they needed to take as much as they could. But
I mean, I would be filling that headband on my head if I were Brand. I'm just saying, there are... I would put it in every crevice of my body, like everything. I'm just saying, like, there's no way one gold coin would help me so much. I'm just thinking of medical school prices now that it's coming up, like, and you with your life get ahead of you coming up next year. I'm just saying, like, the gold would be useful. That's
true. Cost of living isn't getting any lower.
Yeah, COL is, it's bad.
Man. And I don't know whether I'm happy about Intel coming into town.
Yeah.
Because that's just going to make the cost of living still go up.
Yeah, you got to get a place before it's fully built.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you think you can do that?
Like an actual house?
Or yeah.
That I mean, because the housing. I mean that might be tough to do before condo. Intel. Maybe a condo.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't do that right away.
Yeah, it's tough because you know you got to think there's going to be all these people moving in, and then there's going to be like a housing shortage. So the houses are going to go up.
Maybe you should invest in Intel.
So then you could. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Or we could work on continuing to make our multimedia conglomerate powerhouse.
Last resort.
So that I don't really have to worry. And then I become One-Eye Willie with all my treasure.
Possibly, but if you can't beat them, join them. I would just invest in Intel.
yeah, that's true. let's not make this up. I'm not competing against Intel.
Yeah, the last resort versus Intel. We know who. One of them has an extremely intelligent, worldwide dominating AI. The other one has us.
Yeah, they also make like things that are actually useful, like computer chips. Whereas like the desire for people to have content about movies will wax and wane.
And if we
each especially because movies might actually change once AI comes in. Like, I don't know
whether we'll see what happens with the strike.
Yeah. It's interesting though, because I was listening back to some of like the Ringer's like big picture episodes during COVID, and like they were saying about the movies. They were like, I'm not sure whether people are ever going to like go back to movies in the same way that, and then we just had Barbenheimer, and I'm like, okay. Like, it's maybe not the same as before the pandemic. I was about
to say, it's not the same way.
It's not the same way, but it's like, it's not, I think they were painting the worst case scenario. I think we're somewhere in the middle where it's like people are excited about movies occasionally, but it's more of the state of Hollywood that's the problem. But this is a tangent, so.
For sure. The only way that we can create something better than Intel is with if we each separately make babies.
Yeah.
Anyway. So that was a good thought. So, yeah. What do you think, Ben, was your favorite part of this film or the favorite element? Mine, I said, was the interactions between the characters.
Interactions between the characters. That's a good one. Yeah, the overall the props and just the like the whimsy of the film, I think I liked a lot. Like, I liked the villains who are just like the bumbling idiot kind of villains who are like always fighting amongst themselves. They're over the top and ridiculous, and for some reason they speak Italian, and that doesn't really make a ton of sense. Mm-hmm. But it's because like, why are they here? And it's great. But I think ultimately without the characters and the interactions between the characters, the movie would not work.
For sure.
So
because there really isn't.
Yeah, because like, yeah, that's the hook. Is the people, is Mikey speaking at the well, and like, you know, even the stereotypical bully who happens to be the son of the guy who's foreclosing the house is Tony Perkins. Like, that's even sort of necessary to a movie like this.
Sure.
Like, this is a type of movie that made stereotypes in a way. Yeah. Like, sure, there was a stereotype.
So is it backtracking progressive society? That's a stupid question. Anyway, moving on.
I have to unpack that for a second. But I'm just saying, like movies in the future after this would like make stereotypes based on this movie.
Yeah. So maybe these aren't the stereotypical characters. Maybe these are the original wheel that was invented. But I would have to say we are kind of being cylindrical. We're kind of in a roundabout way coming back to the fact that there is not more than meets the eye. This is a great film with interactions between characters that is simple and hilarious, just in the different the different personalities of the characters and the words that they say and the situations that they get into. Maybe it would be more useful to go into the specifics of maybe some more behind the scenes things or some actual interactions that we thought were impressive or some connections that we saw.
And I'll close this section with this. I think it proves that not every movie has to be Inland Empire.
Oh my gosh.
Like, not every movie has to be a puzzle or be super complicated. There's still ways to make, and I think we come back to this with Robert Bresson and all these people. You can make movies that are simple and still make them good. There's like ways to do it because you can still find nuance in simplicity. So you can always try to become the David Lynch who makes like the most complicated thing ever, but you don't have to. And a lot of people should not try to be that.
And maybe the juxtaposition of this to Inland Empire can help us realize the range of movies, as this might be the two endpoints in that range.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is certainly closer to being like Wrath of Khan than it is like in like Wrath of Khan. I think has a lot of similarities to this in that it's like you see more of that like over the top, rambunctious, adventurous, like not too self serious movie that like we still need.
But still, we need much to celebrate. More thoughtful than this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, probably more thoughtful.
Idea of having to face death is
probably deeper themes that overall than they never have to face death truly in this, because it's like I think Siskel from Siskel and Ebert described it as like kind of a comic book esque, like it's that John Hughes where it's like it pushes the bounds of what could actually be real in sort of a comical way. It's kind of that thing that they did in the '80s. I mean, I'm saying John Hughes, but like Spielberg probably did it with like E.T. and stuff, and then this movie also, where they like kind of toe that line where it's like it almost feels like it could be real, and then it goes into sort of like stuff that you're like, okay, I know this is not like can't be real at all, but it still kind of feels like it could be in a strange way.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yes. So where are the cast now? I think that's an interesting thing.
Oh, this is a great.
So let's start with the main character, Mikey Sean Astin. What has he done since then? Has he done much?
Sean Astin has only gone on to play one of the best characters in all of literature.
I know who it is. It is Captain Underpants.
Yes, that's exactly who I was talking about.
He didn't
about.
Play him, but he's in several characters in the...
And Captain Underpants. No, I'm talking about Samwise Gamgee from Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Truly the heart and soul of the Lord of the Rings. And Sean Astin depicted him perfectly in the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Is he good looking?
I mean, he's not amazing.
Is he good looking in the Lord of the Rings?
No. He's like okay. He's like average.
I disagree.
I mean, he's...
I think he is the hottest type of chubby.
I mean, I agree with that. I agree with that. But we're also comparing him to, like, Hollywood people. And then he was in Stranger Things. He played Bob.
He did have a glow down.
A glow down. But he's so lovable. So lovable in Stranger Things. And he has sort of a tragic arc.
Yeah. And no, in Stranger Things, he is one of the... The thing is, like... Think about this, Ben. In this film, in The Goonies, as Bob in Stranger Things, as Samwise in Lord of the Rings, what is in common in all of those characters? They are all the heart of the group. He plays an excellent glue character who brings everyone together, has that speech, keeps everyone accountable, and provides love to everyone. And that is the character that he is just created, made for. He was just amazing in that role. He also starred in some 90s films, Aniko Man, Rudy. He was in all three Lord of the Rings. I have not seen The Hobbit. Don't stone me. Is he in that? I doubt he is.
If he's in it, it's like a
cameo probably. Okay, so they went all Marvel, so they have cameos.
Yeah, I would guess. I never have watched The Hobbit, and I've only heard bad things about it. So you know what else Sean Astin was in? Mom's Night Out.
Oh, great.
You ever watch that movie?
Was he play a mom or?
No, he's the husband of the mom.
I see.
But I remember watching this movie when I was a kid and think it was like the greatest movie ever. It's definitely not at all. It's like one of those.
That when you were a kid?
Yeah, it's like one of those cheap like Christian movies.
Oh, that's a Christian movie. I mean, was thinking that's more like a.
It's not
like a Pitch Perfect.
See, it sounds like that, but it's not.
That's the.
It's
worst
sort of like
thing.
It's sort of like the Christian version of that.
Hold on, that is the worst name to give to a Christian film franchise. I guess it's not a franchise.
I guess maybe it's not Christian, but it's like Christian adjacent. Like there's a lot of, it's like pure flex.
What is Christian adjacent? Judaism?
It's like not super overtly Christian, but they have a lot of Christian like elements.
Pseudo-Christian.
Yeah, pseudo-Christian is a good
way. With a Hollywood name. That sounds like Bad Moms.
Yeah, and it has like Trace Adkins in it, who's a country singer, but he plays like a tattooed, I don't know.
It reminds me of Josh Groban singing, "You raise me up," and then playing Sweeney Todd on Broadway, which I saw a couple months ago.
Honestly, I forget a lot about what the plot of that movie was. But
Sweeney Todd?
Oh, not Sweeney Todd. Mom's Night Out. But Sweeney Todd I have not seen.
Sweeney Todd is great. There's one of the plot lines is they kill people. It's a guy and a girl who are in love. They kill people. He kills people in his barbershop with his blade and takes the body, and underneath his barbershop is a bakery, and they bake the bodies into pies.
And that's like, didn't Andy play Sweeney Todd?
Yeah.
Wasn't that in season 7? Yeah, that's great. I love Andy and his theater. But the thing is, Sean Astin, just looking at his filmography.
And you good?
Excuse me, I'm okay. Has not had an amazing career outside of this movie, Lord of the Rings, and Stranger Things.
He is in the culture pop
hits. You know what he has not had is Corey Feldman's career.
Okay.
Let's talk about Corey Feldman, because he immediately stuck out as like, this is a guy who's like interesting to talk about. Because Corey Feldman was huge as a child star. And he, along with Corey Haim, who I don't think was in this movie.
He was not, but he did apply for it.
but it was also a child star. They're known as the two Coreys. They both got really into drugs. Unfortunately, Corey Feldman.
I didn't know that.
Tragically, at least has said that he was sexually abused in his time as a child star. So extremely troubled. But what I know him from mainly is that, and I don't think I've listened to this whole album, is from his music. Corey Feldman is now a musician.
Okay, that tracks.
You may know his album Angelic to the Core, which is on Spotify. It's 22 songs, 134 minutes. And I don't think we can play it on the podcast, but just look it up. It's fascinating. I remember Anthony Fantano reviewing it. That's the first time I ever heard of Corey Feldman was from this.
Interesting. You're right. In 2013, Feldman has a memoir called Choreography, which is a play on his name. A memoir. And it's about his life being a child star, and sexual abuse, and how Haim, the other Corey, had allegedly suffered at the hands of men in the industry. But they... the people that did this to them, so it was both of them, are still working, they say, and they're out there, and they're some of the most rich and powerful people in the business, and they want me dead, so he's telling them that. And then he did a bunch of songs and stuff about it. And then now, more recently, he did a song called Without You, and he did a film titled, he was in a film called Suicide for Beginners, both released last year. So we can leave it at that. That's pretty...
Yeah. He was also in, and I'll say, he was in Gremlins... which was big, and Stand By Me, which Stand By Me is another classic, yeah. like childhood adventure story. I think it's, who's that big? Stephen King? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a Stephen King novella.
Okay.
That it's based off of. But that's a good movie. And it also I think it's a little, it takes itself a little bit more seriously than The Goonies, but it still is like, has that kind of feeling of like a coming of age.
And you said Gremlins was guys. Chris Columbus's writing as well.
I believe so, yes.
Yes, it was. So that's just another connection. Going into that as well, there was a scene where Chunk had called the police officer to say, hey, I am, we're being attacked, blah, blah, blah. And it's the Boy Who Cried Wolf type of scene. And the police says, oh, just like that time when you said there were those monsters that you poured water on, right? That was a direct quote talking about Gremlins, because in Gremlins, you know, to defeat them, you have to pour the water on them, and that's the So that's because Chris is the writer for both films. He had to include kind of a crossover. So therefore, they both... And in that film, they call the cops too, who don't necessarily come. There are... It's I'm calling it the CCU. The Chris Columbus... No, the CCCU. The Chris Columbus Cinematic Universe. That's what I'm deeming this.
You know what Chunk went on to do?
What did he do?
He became a lawyer. That's what you do when you're a fat... child. I'm not fat. He's
larger than life.
He was chunky. He probably grew out of it.
That was like, the trope in the film. You could say fat.
Yeah, but he probably was smarter than all his actor child actor friends, and he got out of the industry and then went to UCLA School of Law and is a founding partner of Cohen and Gardner Law Firm. So honestly, he might be doing better than financially than a lot of his child actor co-stars.
Yeah, and that is interesting that is his future, as much of the actual film was spent with him being discouraged with the role he was given. He has come out saying he was very insecure on set. He didn't like that they played into the fat trope, and there was even a scene where he shoves a whipped cream into his mouth, and they had to do that scene about 50 times. And in that scene, he says, "I'm depressed," and shoves whipped cream in his mouth. And he said, "Just remember, he remembers feeling so defeated after doing that scene, and he just had a hard time." And yeah, it's just like when he did the truffle shuffle at the beginning in the front of the house, like
yeah, stuff like that. You watch it and you're like, "It's just a movie," but then you're like, "There's actually a kid who's like having to do that."
Yeah. So them playing into that, he was already self-conscious about his weight. So it's just kind of, it was bad. So he goes on, becomes pretty buff, and becomes a lawyer at UCLA School of Law.
So this actually ties into Ki Hu Kwan, who was in Indiana Jones Temple of Doom, famous in that movie. But notably, and if you think about it, it is true. There's not like there wasn't a ton of like Asian American roles throughout Hollywood. And if you think about it, you're like, how many movies other than movies with like Jackie Chan or martial arts movie, which kind of faded out of popularity anyway, have been famous in Hollywood and had a lot of Asian American actors. It doesn't happen, and it was tough for him to get roles, which is unfortunate. But he ended up getting cast in Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is a movie that has a mostly Asian cast, and he ended up winning Best Supporting Actor. That deal for that movie was negotiated by none other than Cohen. Mm-hmm. So, and he was shouted out in the acceptance speech as Goonies Brothers for Life, which is, like, is a cool story. Like,
well, he
that
also
sounds
swept,
like a Hollywood story.
Last year, or this past year, he swept it. He won a Golden Globe, SAG, and Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, like, and you gotta think he has a new career, essentially. I mean, he's gonna be
in other
stuff.
This is a separate career. These are two separate events. And honestly, it felt just like in the Jamie Lee Curtis award. It felt like a legacy award.
Yeah,
where from 1985 to now, you have been in some of the world's biggest movies, and you have not won a single award like this ever.
Although, like, unlike Jamie Lee Curtis, I actually thought that he actually had to perform in a different way than Jamie Lee Curtis, because she still has, like, a total body of work, whereas he was, like, this was essentially him, he as a child actor, and then having to transition to, now I'm an adult actor, I have to take the aspects of what I was like as a child actor and try to, like, portray that as an adult. And I actually think it worked really well in Everything
Everywhere
All at
Once. For sure, his voice is the exact same.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a lot of those quirks that you see in Data in this movie, he used in Everything Everywhere All at Once. So, and that's kind of, not every actor can, I mean, even the best actors, even like Daniel Day-Lewis, like, you start to understand that there's limitations with what you can do. It's kind of hard to not play into who you are. Mm-hmm. And so the best thing to do generally is to embrace it and then hope that there's roles that you can fill that fit into movies.
For sure. Now let's do a little speed run. So we got John Mudaczek, who played Sloth. He was an NFL player. He was the first pick in the 1973 NFL draft.
Wow, that's actually impressive.
Played for the Kansas City Chiefs and Washington Commanders before being in the Oakland Raiders. And he won two Super Bowls. And then before he was in the Goonies, he was also in the North Dallas 40 from 1979, the Ice Pirates in 84. And then in Goonies after that, he was in One Crazy Summer from 86. And he wrote an autobiography in 87 called Cruisin'. And then he died in 89, overdose of prescription drugs at the age of 38, unfortunately. Another speed run. So you got Martha Plimpton, who was Steph, and she was in the Goonies. And she went on to have a kind of a steady career moving forward. The Mosquito Coast, Running and Empty. She was in lots of shows such as ER, How to Make It in America, The Real O'Neills. And she was nominated for a lead actress in a bunch of TV shows. In Raising Hope, she was nominated. Yeah, so she's kind of had a lot of... and now she's more in politics and stuff like that. Cary Grant, and then we're going to get into Josh Brolin, who is my favorite. Cary Grant, Andy, was, since the Goonies, she's been in many other films such as Lucas, Three for the Road, she was with Charlie Sheen in that film, and she has been in ER alongside of Martha Plimpton, and Mad About You, In the Heat of the Night, and she was in Complacent.
And it sort of seems like she may have retired kind of after like 2001-ish.
Yeah, she had a film in 2012. I don't know why I said 19.
Yeah, but it's like it doesn't even have a link.
It stood alone. Now, let's get to the big shot. Joshua Brolin, who plays Brand in this film, has had probably one of the most successful careers besides Sean Astin.
I think his career is easily the best of anybody
of
in
these,
this movie. Yeah.
I think so. I think
he's had the most successful career.
And his looks have been steady.
Yeah,
for sure.
Because you look at the movies he's been in. I mean, No Country for Old Men obviously is the one that comes to mind. But like the Old Boy remake, Inherent Vice, Hail Caesar,
Sicario,
Dune. You know, he's working with Denis Villeneuve. He's working with Paul Thomas Anderson. He's working with the Coen brothers.
He played Cable in Deadpool too.
Now, honestly, I think he's, even though he's the most successful, he's still a more underrated actor. He's sort of in that, sure, like Clive Owen.
Even though he did play Thanos, which is the biggest role.
But it's
role.
Like, that's what happens when you play a voice acting role, and like that's
because
people kind of
forget.
I know he did.
Yeah.
Like, I know he did all of that.
You call that voice acting?
Okay, fine. It's not voice acting.
He did the mouth. He did. That was his face just edited.
Yeah, I know, but people are still not gonna like look at that and be like, "Oh, that's Josh Brolin." They're just gonna be like, "That's Thanos."
I do that.
I mean, that kind of happens with like any actor in Marvel movies, though. It takes away their stardom a little bit.
I understand what you mean, but Josh Brolin, just the sheer intensity of his career has pushed him to the forefront. Probably first, second being Sean Astin.
And The Goonies is his first credit. So without The Goonies, there wouldn't be no Josh Brolin. I really, like, I know Javier Bardem has a great performance in No Country for, like, a sensational performance in No Country for Old Men. Tommy Lee Jones has a sensational performance in No Country for Old Men. But I love Josh Brolin's performance as Llewellyn Moss in No Country for Old Men. And I also like, well, this is weird. I also like the Cary McDonald's performance as his wife. But so maybe I'm just saying that everyone's performance in No Country for Old Men is amazing.
Yeah.
But Josh Brolin is a fantastic actor.
For sure. And an interesting thing, so we can probably get into some of the key things behind the scenes or cool parts that we thought about. There was an interesting story that I read upon in an article talking about how all of the cast in the last few weeks of filming were kind of cold to Richard Donner. Richard Donner felt a little bit concerned. He's like, why is everybody kind of shooting me off, not making me relevant? And it comes to fruition that as Richard Donner and his wife go on a vacation to Hawaii, Steven Spielberg had secretly bought tickets for the entire child cast to go to Hawaii and surprise him on his vacation following the end of production. And Richard Donner ends up showing up at the door to the place that he was staying, and it was just apparently not the best reaction. He was, you know, kind of surprised and whimsically happy, but at the same time, he's like, "This was my vacation. I was excited to be on this trip." That's just a funny story. I thought that, like, the entire cast for the last few weeks of production literally cut him off. Did not say anything outside of the filming that they needed to do. So it was just a hilarious thing.
Yeah, that is a crazy story.
It shows how fun and friendly Spielberg keeps his sets. And that's how you make a great movie as well, if you have everybody on board.
Yeah, that's true. It's like any other project. Yeah, you have to keep everyone engaged with it. Because if you want to see the humanity of the actors, you're going to have to make sure that they're, like, working together cohesively. And I guess to talk about Richard Donner, he actually did have a very successful career as well. I guess arguably maybe he is the person you could say had a more successful career than Josh Brolin. Probably not, but it's since he's not from the same era, it's harder to compare.
Well, if we're putting them in there too, then Spielberg would be one.
Yeah, well, yeah, but Spielberg I don't consider as closely related to this movie, but he was definitely
helped
with the story. What does that mean? It's so vague. I don't know exactly what
they did. They just put his name on there so people see it.
I mean, he was a selling point, certainly. But he did Superman, which is probably what kind of really actually kickstarted the superhero wave eventually.
And in this film, when Sloth rips his shirt off and there's a Superman, it plays a little da 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 da.
Man. I didn't realize how interconnected they made the Richard Donner stuff and the Chris Columbus stuff. That's so funny. Also did the Lethal Weapon franchise, which is hugely successful.
They use weapons in this film.
And then Scrooged is another one that's pretty well known. Yeah. But, I mean, that's the thing. It's like a couple movies that are really like standouts, and then other ones you're like, these might have been big at the time. But, I mean, who's watching Assassins with Sylvester Stallone? Like, I've never heard of that movie. It's maybe a great movie, but... I've personally never heard of it.
Yeah, and I think the actors actually thought that Spielberg and Donner, I was reading upon it, that they were kind of both involved in the directorial
Okay, so this is sort of one of those things where it's like Donner gets the credit, but Spielberg kind of like
he does a lot
does,
of creative
does his thing. Okay, yeah.
And I think they like to work together. They're very, I mean, the fact that Spielberg created that practical prank against Donner means that they had some kind of close relationship.
Yeah,
I'm sure they did. The Inferno, which is the pirate ship that is in that cave, was like it was like 150 feet or longer than that. And it was constructed for this film, for that scene and the end. And it was pretty impressive. And actually the models that they used to make this were also used for the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, which is hilarious.
That's amazing.
So it was just funny to see that connection as well. But it is cool that they actually worked so hard on and it really isn't a big part of the film that, like, they're in these caves, and you can see where the money went in this film. They're in these caves, like, kind of low budget. The background's really dark, and it's just kind of like, you could probably do this really cheap. And then they have this beautiful big pirate ship. It was kind of blown away. I was thinking, like, halfway through the film, I was like, wow, this film was made really cheap. And then I saw the pirate ship, and I was like, that's an amazing thing. So, yeah, it was kind of cool. And then there was also a scene at the end where Data says, we were attacked by an octopus, right?
Yeah.
Apparently, I was like, wait, did that actually happen? And I thought that maybe I dozed off or thought of something else during that scene. Apparently, that was a cut scene where they had made this big octopus to attack them. And they had cut it away. And I was like, oh, that makes much more sense. How I had not remembered it.
Wow.
And it was cut. Yeah, so it was kind of annoying that they did that. But the ship itself was very impressive. I'm glad they were able to do all of that. And even though the filming was done, much of it was done in Astoria, the actual Goonies house was able to be visited for about a couple decades after the movie had been released. And then shortly after that, the owner of it got sick of all, you know, 1,500 people coming a day.
It's like the Breaking Bad house.
Yeah, and people throwing pizzas on the roof.
You're like, why don't you just sell your house, make it a Goonies museum?
And you then have to imagine how many fat people. Okay, how many people? It's the same with
the Breaking Bad house. Okay, I would never pass zoning, but you're like, just sell the house, make it. It's a Breaking Bad museum now. Yeah, you could so probably much money. Make. It's probably you can sell it for like way more than the house is actually worth.
But I have and family then, here.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Who cares?
People are gonna throw pizzas on your house. It's deemed to be that way.
And also, if you're gonna agree to let your house be used for a TV show, like you're gonna have like.
Or if you bought the house, and this person bought the house post Goonies.
Okay, yeah. See, you have to know that.
That is her fault.
Unless it's like the real estate agent pulled a cheap one on them.
Yeah, like nobody's been murdered here.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I would buy a discount house that someone had been murdered in a heartbeat. I don't care about that,
Ben. But our friends who are females who just bought a house or kind of renting a house now.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Someone was definitely murdered in that basement. At their place.
Seriously?
Oh, for sure. I am predicting it. There, if you go down there, it looks intricately designed to hide dead bodies.
Wow.
We'll have to see it sometime.
We'll have to see whether there are still some there.
I'm not going to lie. This is going to sound really demented. Maybe I shouldn't say this. But like, if I find a dead body, it'll slightly excite me. Not in the sense that it'll be great. It's a horrible, horrifying thing.
Yeah, but I get it's like gets you, it gives you that sense of like.
It's giving me the Goonies feeling.
Yeah, exactly.
Like when they found a dead body and they had that skeleton.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like that.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And maybe we can go on some escapades down deeper into into the cave.
I just feel like if it happened in real life, it would not be as magical as in the Goonies. It would be like.
No, it would be horrifying.
It would be horrifying. Yeah, it would be.
Yeah. So.
Here's a final question. Do you prefer movies that are more grounded and you're like, this could be real life? Or do you like when movies play into the fact that no movies are actually like real life because they can't be? Otherwise, that'd be a documentary. And even that is questionably like real life.
There are two sides of the same coin, which is a stupid phrase within itself because it makes no sense. But so the way I relate to people mostly is through movies until more recently when I've gained a lot of social skills in the last, 5 years. Before that, I like Abed from Community, had to relate to people through film. So I see why the grounded nature of it would be helpful to not only give me more experience and to give me thought processes, but how I can relate the realistic nature of the film to real life. But then also the subjective nature of it being that I can realize where the disconnect of reality is. But I don't necessarily care. When I read a book, I prefer nonfiction, besides my favorite book, which is Peter Pan, and my favorite uninspired book. And I think it would be an interesting thing to kind of compare nonfiction movies to fiction movies, because I don't really have an answer, because I see both sides of the same coin. If I had to pick, I would probably pick nonfiction, because I think the bigger franchises that I'm into are nonfiction, and most movies tend to be nonfiction. Even when they're loosely based off of something that's real, I call that fiction.
Yeah. Wait, do you mean most movies tend to be fiction?
Yeah.
You said nonfiction. But you mean fiction.
That's what I meant.
Because I was like, I feel like most movies are fiction. Yeah. Because if they're not, If they're not fiction, then they're usually considered a documentary.
Yeah. It's like trying to say the at the beginning. I was asking if that was a word. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think I see what you're saying. And I think I agree. I think the magic of movies is that they can't happen in real life. Like, why else would you have – what the source of entertainment is that you can, like, go beyond the bounds of, like, regular mundane life. But then at a certain point, that becomes tired, and then you, like, go back and you become, like, Jim Jarmusch and you pull on things that are more mundane. But that you're still pulling something out of them, like we talked about.
For sure. Or you can go to the conceptual level like David Lynch. And we're not going to bring up our favorite directors right now because we made a vow to not say them. And I broke that vow last episode.
Yeah. Or you become really self-referential and you just base your movies on other movies.
Sure. Like someone we know.
Or you just make movies about Hollywood, which you can, like David Lynch, where you're like, okay, now I make movies
Or about. Also like someone that we know.
Yeah.
Also in his latest film. But I think... The idea, I've thought about this a lot, Ben. This is a great question. And you say that the magic is found within the fact that we cannot experience real life just like we see in the film. I think there's also magic in real life that we cannot see in film.
That is, that is definitely true.
I think there are two sides of the same stupid phrase coin that I have come to appreciate. And the fact that I've thought about it so much means that I don't really have a side because I see both sides.
Yeah. Well, because also life is... Movies can be predictable, and what we like about them sometimes is that they like break molds and they break rules, whereas life is maybe predictable in some senses, but is also unpredictable and out of our control. A movie allows us to like experience like these emotions, like tension, while ultimately being able to walk away unchanged in a sense. I mean, we might be changed a little bit and affected by the story, but we can go back to like the regular life we were living.
I see.
Whereas if some of the stuff that happened to people in movies happened to you in real life, it would like scar you.
Yeah.
And you'd have emotional trauma for the rest of your life. So you can experience all of those things without having to actually experience them.
Yeah.
But that's the same thing with like literature that's fiction and like other stuff that's been happening for centuries and art. So it's just like how humans were designed kind of to be able to be creative and think like that.
Yeah.
And grapple with things, I guess. In some ways, we're trying to put ourselves in different scenarios by creating movies and thinking about like how we would react to things or see how other people would react to things.
Mm-hmm. I think it's innate. I think there is the idea of film being the anchor that we can go to, the anchor of that life is consistent and that change is inevitable, but we can still be anchored to these conceptual ideas of the hero's journey. And I think that's innate within all humans. And I think it's refreshing to break free from those chains in all these Oscar bait movies, right?
Right, yeah.
But I think that hero's journey is there no matter what form it takes or what order it takes in David Lynch's example. I think
the sometimes the hero's journey just doesn't end well.
Yeah, and we all crave this anchoring to the hero's journey. We all crave redemption. It's getting philosophical, theological. You can go into all different directions with this, but we all crave this type of innate redemption hero's journey arc that – there is a hero, and the hero is faulty, right? And he makes mistakes. But at the end of the day, he comes to terms with those mistakes and fixes his mistakes. And I think that idea, even if there's a villain involved, even if the villain is conceptual or ideological, or the villain is himself or herself, that is just something that we can all relate to because sometimes our worst villains are ourselves or ideas, especially in our real lives. And that's the anchor that we have to hold on to within not only our life but within our consuming our entertainment and consuming all of these different medias that we now see. We see all these different ads and all these different promoters from different angles of different lives, and you go to New York City and this is overwhelming. You know, you see these people from different backgrounds, from different cultures, all talking about different ideas at the same time, and it becomes really confusing. But the anchor in films is this hero's journey, the thing that we actually can relate to, the thing that we're called to, the thing that we're drawn to, the thing within our soul that makes us want to watch these.
Yeah, right? Wow, that's very profound.
Thanks.
And I couldn't have said it any better. I have to agree. Yeah, that's what caused people to come back, and it is because everyone's searching. They're searching for that answer that they think they can find in the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. That call to redemption of sorts.
Almost like we have a problem in our lives, in our psyche, our soul, whatever you want to call it. I say the soul, and there's something disconnected, and that disconnection can always be smoothed out by the hero's journey, because then you're faced with what you need to do next in your own life. And it kind of makes things clear. Like, yeah, I am the problem. That most of the time it's that. Sometimes it's other people. Sometimes right. it's yeah. an idea or a concept that needs a little kinked in your brain that the neurons aren't firing correctly, or you're not connecting ideas or using wisdom or discernment. But it's like, at the end of the day, a lot of times you are the problem. And in Goonies, we never say die, right? That's the moral of the story.
Yeah,
never give up. You Goonies, keep going forward.
Goonies never say die.
You keep yeah. going in this linear fashion down the cave into this deeper and deeper. Even though the plot itself is simple, it goes deeper and it finds new ways to do that, because this is a family. The Goonies are family. They have one mission, not to get rich. They don't get distracted. They don't get in fights. They don't even have these deep underlying concerns for safety. At most of the time they're saying things that are really dumb, but the fun part of it that Spielberg understands is the whimsical, magical, adventurous nature that we can all anchor ourselves to. And this metaphorical adventure can be applied to our lives, where you just keep moving forward in our life no matter what, suffering, through pain, through agony, through what's the medium thing that could happen? Not the worst, not the easiest.
Getting stuck in traffic on 270.
Yeah, which happened to you today.
Yeah. That's like a median thing. Yeah. A medium thing.
I would say so.
It's like an inconvenience.
Yeah.
Really?
And that's what I felt yeah. these characters went through.
Yeah, they went through some
minor inconvenience of the Fratellis trying to kill them.
Yeah, but like, you knew they weren't actually going to kill them.
Exactly. Because it's Spielbergian. There's magic. There's sparkles.
Yeah.
And it feels good. And that's what maybe that's what I should have said. It feels good.
Yeah.
It's like the first sip of coffee in the morning.
Yeah. It's sort of like the first time you shoot up heroin.
Oh, sure.
I'm just kidding.
Taking a very serious subject and applying it to this. Yeah, I agree. Although we have never done that, I have to say, for legal reasons.
I've legitimately never done that.
Yeah, neither have I. Legitimately. I have to say legitimately to make it legit.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, you have to. If you say legitimately, then... Everyone takes you seriously. It was a clever joke where you anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you stuck it well.
Yeah. All right. We have so many ideas, but I think we'll have plenty of more movies to go on more tangents about.
Yeah.
About stuff. So I think it's about time that we.
Was that a tangent? Wrap this thing up. What defines?
I mean, it's not really a tangent, other than the idea is like we're talking about the Goonies, but then we end up talking about something like
deeply have to be
philosophical. What, I mean, all conversations are just tangents.
Wow.
Right? Aren't they? Because they just start somewhere and then they just take a turn. And you're right. You can't really define where that turn is all the time.
So there's no straight path.
Through a conversation?
All conversations are angled at some point. We just have to connect those and somehow angle them to the right, to the left, to the right, to the left, almost zigzag, so that we're going in the right direction.
Yeah. Unless you have like a really structured way to like never – go off topic, but even the concept of like what is topic
yeah,
is
even
sort
if
of,
you zoom in there's
because then you have to define points. Like what is the guidelines between where you can actually talk about this thing.
There is no straight
like
line.
When we're talking about the Goonies and you start talking about Corey Feldman, am I allowed to say what else Corey Feldman did? Is that like still talking about the Goonies?
Am I allowed to ask if Sean Astin is still hot?
Yeah, like is that really applicable? Because that happened after the Goonies.
That was a right degree turn and you corrected it. You said yeah. Oh, let's move on to the next guy. So then that was a left turn. And in the end, four left turns makes a – what is the phrase?
Three left turns.
Three left turns. Wait. One, one, two. Three left turns makes a right. I had to do it in my head. A future physician. Yeah. So, yeah, and then the difference between that and a rabbit hole. And the meta commentary on this is that we are ourselves in a rabbit hole / tangent. And whatever we define it as is what it is technically, right? Because the mode of conversation is what we are defining. So therefore, yeah. We are on track. And that is what we're going to go with.
Mm-hmm. And okay. Now we can close the vault.
Okay. I feel like that the end conversation that we just had about tangents and defining our own reality really negates all the truth-telling we told before.
Yeah. We sort of, here at the Movie Vault, we sort of dabble in some paradoxes of...
paradoxes of thought and truth
of
and
thought
reality.
And truth and reality. We do hold on to one truth, but sometimes we like to just experiment with our thoughts.
Sometimes we have to know if what we're thinking is rational. And if it's not, we still not only rational, we rationalize how it's not rational.
Yeah.
But then you got to know, like, how is knowledge obtained? How is it acquired? And all that.
Yeah. Then you just get confused, you know? You just got to believe something.
That's when you just sit back and watch the Goonies and feel good. Like sipping the first cup of coffee or apparently heroin, I guess. So,
yeah.
Yeah. One or the other. Hopefully the coffee, because heroin's a terrible drug.
Don't do heroin.
Yeah.
I feel like that goes without saying, but in today's day and age, you don't really know.
Well, I mean, we're going to get canceled and lifted up at the same time.
Yeah, true.
We are the exact middle ground.
Yeah, in some ways, yes. Actually, in other ways, no.
Probably not at all.
We're not the middle ground. But in fact, we probably are sort of an enigma in film criticism. But I won't go further into that.
This is the last thing.
Okay.
Is it only because we dig our own graves that we're this enigma?
Maybe.
Okay.
I also just think that we attack art at a generally different worldview than most people who are like into film.
But are we doing that on the basis that we're only critiquing every single type of thing that we can critique, or are we actually making solid statements of truth? Are we just critics?
I think in a lot of ways, yes, we're critics, because how can every thought about art be a solid statement of truth? Because there's certain things we're critiquing that aren't objective realities. But I think when it comes to our views on the world and religion and what we believe about God, like that would generally be different than a lot of people who are.
For sure. Those are more objective.
Yeah. And we're considering them objective truths, whereas there's a lot of more wishy-washy critics out there who are like judging films by different guidelines in some senses.
Yeah.
But also then there's a lot of people who believe what we believe who would just not watch the movies that we watch.
Do you ever think we...
So we're just sort of...
Do you ever think like we should just feel good about a film?
No. My brain is not wired that way.
Okay.
I don't think I can just feel good about a movie.
No,
I can. I absolutely can, because at the same time, Donnie Darko is my favorite movie. If I had to be like the most pretentious person in the world, I would have like canned Donnie Darko being my favorite movie a long time ago and come up with something way more pretentious. Because Donnie Darko is one of those movies that like you think you know a lot about movies, and then you're like, this is my favorite movie. And then you become more pretentious.
Not to the degree of Inception.
It's like the next level beyond Inception.
Interstellar.
Yeah, it's like Interstellar. But like I become self-aware, and I'm like, if I picked another movie, I would just be trying to be more like to prove myself, which is actually not very genuine. So if you want to be a good film critic, you have to actually be somewhat genuine. You can't just be following the crowd of like, oh, now all of a sudden I like European art house films like a ton, and they're like all my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Or I like the Czech New Wave or whatever.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, this goes into the coffee realm, this goes into the clothing realm, any realm where subjective interpretations are made. If someone likes Folgers, good for them. Okay?
Yeah, it's like if someone likes Taylor Swift, good for them. I mean, I have a hard time saying good for them.
I agree with you.
Yes. I mean, Folgers and Taylor Swift to me are like the equivalent.
You just offended 95% of our audience.
I know. And I'm very close with certain people who love Taylor Swift, so I have to acknowledge that it's possible that she just is not, like, I'm just not her target audience.
Okay.
But, like, because I like to come into looking at art and pretend there's an objective way to look at it.
But you would say the only reason you are not her target audience is because you have taste.
No, it's, I mean.
That distinguishes you.
But even if I did not have taste, I would also probably not really relate to her lyrics that much.
What, you've never broken up with a guy in a barn?
No, I have not.
I mean, I don't know.
So there's a lot of things that... And Jake Gyllenhaal is one of my favorite actors.
And she disses him.
And she disses him. And all Taylor Swift fans hate Jake Gyllenhaal, like, passionately. Wow. They want him to die. I mean, they should all watch Nightcrawler, because they would all believe that's what he's actually like in real life. Which, to be fair, I actually don't know. He could actually be like that in real life.
There's but a line from The Office.
I think he's an amazing actor. I don't think that anything about his personality changes the fact that he's a really good actor.
He's cool. He's one of the best. Dwight walks into a room and says, "Ugh, we need a new plague." And that's what we're going to end with today.
Okay. That's it. All right.